Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is May 26, 2017, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Don't Give Up. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Brian Goldman. He is an emergency medicine physician working at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. He's also the host of the CBC radio show, White Coat, Black Art, and the author of the best-selling books, The Night Shift and The Secret Language of Doctors. Welcome to the SGEM, Brian.
My pleasure to be speaking with you.
Well, this is an SGEM Extra book review, and we're doing this in a coffee shop. We're doing this as a very low-key, sort of very intimate sort of experience while we sip some coffee and talk about kindness. And there was so much positive feedback that I got on the episode I did with Jeannie Lenser about her book on the danger within us that I thought, you know what, I'm going to do it again. You had Jeannie on the show, didn't you?
Yeah, she's a lot smarter than me. She knows her stuff when it comes to the lack of oversight of medical devices, and we should be listening to her.
Yeah, we should absolutely be listening to her. Well, you have this fantastic new book called The Power of Kindness, Why Empathy is Essential in Everyday Life. So what got an emergency medicine physician like yourself on the path of discovery about kindness?
A few years ago, I started to give talks on empathy, and in fact, I called it empathy schmempathy because
is that Yiddish?
Yeah, it's kind of Yiddish. It's a bit of a Yiddishism, and you know, the idea was who needs it, or if everybody's supposed to have it, then maybe it's so trivial that nobody should talk about it. And you know, I had a few experiences in my life, in my career as an emergency physician. I've been doing this for more than 30 years, and including one in which I saw an older woman who's my patient. She was brought to the emergency department in the end stages of a degenerative disease. She could no longer speak for herself, so I couldn't take a history from her. She was on a pureed diet. And her family, who doted on her, thought she needed to be admitted to hospital. Now, this was at a time when, probably still true now, but was especially true then, not great home care, not great palliative care. And so a lot of families would, in a kind of a heartsick way, bring their loved one to the emergency department and say, we can't do this anymore.
And it's really hard to admit someone under a diagnosis of failure to cope. Because it's not them that's not coping, it's the system that's not coping with their needs.
Exactly. But what do? We slangify it. I talked about it in The Secret Language of Doctors. You said failure to cope, dyscopia, social admission. They're all pejoratives that stereotype what happens, the behavior, not the person. It says nothing about the person. And I couldn't pay attention to any of that because it was years before I was sensitized to what that was all about. So I'm not an idiot. I had every intention of referring her to the internist on call, to the internal medicine team on call. But as is their wont, they prioritize patients, and a social admission is not a high priority item. This woman was not dehydrated. She didn't have sepsis. She didn't have aspiration. She just needed to be admitted to hospital, and so she was probably properly placed very low down a list of other more important things to do. It took a long time for the internist, the internal medicine resident, to see the patient. And so that put me into the position of Brian, the emergency physician in the middle. Anybody who works in the ER knows exactly what this is like. Families asking, when is she going to be admitted? When's the internist going to see her? You know, when is she going to get a bed? Can I go now? Can I come back? Can you? Well, you don't know. Can you approximate the time? You know how the wise professor says, a good physician, an ethical, humble physician knows how to say, I don't know, which is all true. But just try saying that 17 times in a row, because at some point, somebody's going to say something snappy like, well, if you can't answer any of our questions, why don't you bring us somebody who can?
Or you're going to turn around and be snappy with them.
Which is exactly what I did. There was a moment when one of the daughters asked, did you actually make the referral? And I bristled and I snapped at her, and as soon as it came out, I thought, oh, you don't do that, Goldman. That was a really dumb thing to do. Anyway, she finally got seen by the internist, got admitted to hospital, and I have to confess that I'm thinking to myself, one of the perks of being an ER physician is that my difficult patients become somebody else's problem. Bye-bye. And then she passed away a couple months later. She was at the end stage of a degenerative disease. And then a few months after that, I got a letter from the husband. You know, not an email, not a phone call. you know, when I read it, I kind of slumped in the chair. I got busted. And it was like, basically, he accused me of unkindness. He invited me to a meeting with the family so that I could learn what, you know, what a woman she was like as a mother, a wife, an accomplished woman, so that he could see if there was, and I'm quoting now, a human being lurking under all of that brusqueness.
That must have been quite a shock to your ego. I mean, you know, you're a highly accomplished, well-spoken, you know, all the accolades that go to reach that pinnacle of, you know, working at Mount Sinai and doing all the things you're doing, and then all it takes is a letter from a widow to really bring you back down to earth.
Yeah, and you know, if he had accused me of incompetence, nobody likes that. But I could probably have brushed that one off, you know, unless it's a physician.
Because you're not incompetent, though. That's what, you know, like, it's not about the medicine.
But if they say you're unkind, everybody on the planet knows what unkind is. That probably was the beginning. I had the shame response, which I'll talk about, because I think it's, if you want to know what's my, you want to know what my journey is, I'll talk about it. We'll park that for a few minutes. It planted the seed of getting me thinking about when else I was unkind. And there were other times. I had an interest in empathy as a personal kind of journey. Also, you know, I looked at the, you know, the world of medicine and healthcare and didn't think that I was the most unkind person in the medical world. In fact, I thought I was one of a kind, one of many. I can tell you about my background in a moment, why I think I probably started off kind, but I can tell you that first case with that patient in whom I ignored the feelings of her family, that was the yin to the yang. About 15 or 20 years later, I was at the bedside of my father, who had just passed away. And I missed that because I had worked the night shift the night before. I'd been up for about 40 hours. I never went to sleep. The last day of his life, the retirement home where he was living called. Personal support worker said, he doesn't feel like getting out of bed. I ran up to see him. He had advanced coronary artery disease, untreatable surgically. They had attempted 3 years before his death to do what would have been a very complicated angioplasty. It was high risk. He would have required a lot of contrast, probably would have wrecked his kidneys, which were already suffering from the effects of chronic type 2 diabetes. So he was always a thimble-sized blood clot in one of his coronary arteries from passing away. So I ran up to see him. He had chest pain. We called the paramedics. He actually said, I just want to rest here. And you know, in retrospect, I know that he was dying, and he wanted to remain in a comfortable bed, in a comfortable setting. He was brought to the emergency department. He rallied, and then he started to have more chest pain. And finally, you know, we saw the internist. The internist looked at the records and said, you know, we'll try medically to manage him medically. Didn't talk about the gravity of the situation. We said, my sister and I said instantly, DNR. Because, you know, or allow a natural death because it was the right thing to do. Anyway, we got him upstairs to a bed, telemetry bed, and about 10 o'clock at night, I'd been up about 40 hours at this point. I was exhausted. My dad said, I'd like to rest now. You should go home. And he sent us all home, me, my partner, Tamara, my sister Joanne, my brother-in-law Rob. And I took a step towards the door and impulsively went back to my father's bedside, leaned over, kissed him on the forehead, and said, for the one and only time in my life and his, I love you. It's not because we didn't love each other. It's because he was of a kind, of a certain age, where you don't say I love you, you show it. And he did. Went home, don't remember my head hitting the pillow. Then the next thing I remember dimly is being shaken and hearing my name several times until I wake up and I saw Tamara's stricken face, and I just said, he's gone, isn't he?
You knew.
I knew.
You knew when you were leaving the room.
Yeah, I knew, but I was, you know, I think I was running away from the moment. Anyway, I went back to the bedside, and he had the most calm, peaceful look on his face. Like, as if the troubles of 3 years and it had been terrible. Like, getting really old really sucks. And then in the middle of this moment of processing what I'm seeing, my sister's there, my brother-in-law's there, in walks the internist and the night duty nurse. And the internist is speaking out, spitting out these sentence fragments. His blood pressure went down. His heart rate went down. We tried to reach you. And at that moment, I think he thought I was the angry doctor's son from hell who was about to start screaming at him. And I was a son who was processing my dad's death. And at that moment, I wanted empathy, a pat on the shoulder, something that said, this really sucks, doesn't it? It's going to change everything forever, and it does. But all I was thinking about was not offending him. And I found the words, thank you for looking after my dad, tumbling out of my mouth. He relaxed, because I think he thought, well, okay, there's not going to be a confrontation. He said, take all the time you need. And they both left. And that moment was really the moment after I processed it that I understood what that family had felt so many years before. That's why I call them the yin-yang of my experiences. And that's the two of them together set me off on the journey, because it wasn't that I was angry at him. I'm not angry. I never was angry with him. And the reason why is that I have been where he stood. I have been him. And I think, I'm not sure that all of our colleagues would agree that they've been where he is, where I was so self-possessed and so personally tuned into my own distress that I couldn't possibly empathize with this other person in front of me, because I keep thinking that they're going to scream at me, which means I'm paying attention to me. And you can't empathize with somebody when you are that self-preoccupied.
I try to keep it in the back of my mind on shift. They're having a worse day than you are. And no matter how bad the day is, or the rails are coming off, or beds, ambulances, whatever it is, the patient and the patient's family, they'd prefer not to be there, and they're having a worse day than I am, and I'll be going home at the end of it, and they may not. But that keeps me centered. But something that you said, and I just want to say this out loud, is I heard in your description of your dad, he was saying goodbye. He was allowing everybody, it's time to go. It's time for me to go. And my father-in-law gave me some great advice a long time ago. Ken, you got to show up for life. You don't have to show up for the funeral, but you got to show up for when they're alive and show them that you love them. Sometimes tell them that you love them. And I've got a father too, sort of similar. It's, you don't say it, you just show it.
Yeah.
So I get that. But we've been talking a lot about kindness, and we haven't even defined the term yet. So I did a little homework with your book, and apparently kindness comes from this old English term, kind, spelled C-Y-N-D, and it means kinship or friends who are two of a kind. But how are you defining kindness when you're talking about it? When you say kindness, what do you mean?
So there are banal definitions of kindness, showing compassion, extending a gesture of friendliness. To me, those very superficial words are to the phenomenon I'm talking about, what sympathy is to empathy. Sympathy, there are some metaphorical diagrams that you can see on the internet. Sympathy, imagine the person in despair. Either they've lost someone they love, their business has gone belly up, they've been fired from a job, whatever it is, they're in at the bottom of a deep pit of despair. The person who's extending sympathy is standing at the top, looking down. Maybe they say something semi-empathetic, like, it's a long way down there, it's detached, and it really comes from a place of, I don't know what to say. So you get banal things like, sorry for your loss. And it's more about what do I say on an occasion like this, which is not standing shoulder to shoulder with the other person. Empathy, on the other hand, is not standing at the top of the pit looking down. It's standing beside the person at the bottom of the pit of despair. And, it would be facile for me to say that I always know what my patients are suffering from. That's why peer support counselors started in addictions, have now moved into mental health. And it's because the people who can empathize with you the most have been through, maybe a little ahead of you, but have been through what you're going through right now, and they actually know what it's like. So back to kindness. Kindness is not about me being nice to somebody with having no idea what nice to that person means. Example, I see somebody who is older, and I run to open a door for them, and they're insulted. I expect them, I've done a nice thing. I've got my brownie points for today. You know, I've paid it forward. And they're shooting darts at me with their eyes because they're proud. Because they haven't quite gotten used to the idea that people think they need help. And as I get older and people begin to finish my sentences and speed me up a little bit in the emergency department, can we get to the point a little faster, Brian? You know, I have to accept that with equanimity because they're trying to extend something to me, but it may not be kindness. Kindness, like to extend a gesture, a meaningful gesture of kindness, you have to peer into somebody's soul long enough, or at least enough, to have a sense of what they really need at that moment and then provide it. So there's a bit of intuition. If you do functional MRIs, if we can get neuroscientific about it for a moment, there's a good chance that if you put each of them in a functional MRI machine, separate ones, while one is extending the gesture to the other, you might be surprised to learn that the same parts of their brain are lighting up in exactly the same way that mom and newborn's brains would light up identically. That's called synchrony.
That was my next point. And it was like, I'm just thinking of synchrony, and I was going to avoid saying synchronicity because I'm stuck in the 80s and I'm always thinking about the Police and that wonderful album and song that had Synchronicity. But synchrony and
hey, I'm sending an SOS to the world.
And I've noticed it, like, I mean, somebody told me that when you meet someone in the emergency department, you should be able to walk out of the room and tell them the color of their eyes. So you make a connection and you go, I've looked in their eyes. Or, like we've been doing, we've been mimicking each other's hand motions without even knowing it. But we're getting in sync, right? And so that's what you're talking about on the functional MRI?
Yeah. And if we're in a coffee shop, you can see the people who are getting along with each other by their hand talk. If you see the matching hand talk, matching up talk, then you know they're cooking. What's interesting is that a therapist and a client who get into synchrony, their therapeutic alliance is stronger. Their insights, the insights that are coming from the therapist are more true, and the client is more likely to follow the advice of the therapist or the journey. They feel as if they're on a journey together instead of one fighting the other.
Well, we've all had shifts like that where we're working with certain nurses and certain staff, and it just feels like click, 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 and you're just, oh, it's moving so well. And then other times you just feel like you're just out of sync. You're not connecting with people.
And there may be reasons for that are, you know, maybe you just don't click, or it may be that one of the two, or maybe both, are paying attention to their own distress that comes from. And I think this has a lot to do with it. Like, we have a certain innate ability, which I'm sure you're going to want to talk about, but nurture and experience gets in the way. And I can tell you that for sure, that if you are distressed and focusing on your own stuff when you start your shift, when you go in to see a patient in a cubicle, you will not connect with them, and they'll know it. There'll be something about you that's off. They probably won't know a lot about this stuff. They won't be able to put their finger on it, much less give the reason for it. But the therapeutic alliance will be affected. And that's bad news because, you know, I'm sure as you've experienced, as I've experienced, good things happen when you clear the crap out and you let that still small voice that says, you know, don't send this patient home. Try a little harder to make that diagnosis of aortic dissection, which I know you've talked about lately. Wild-ass guess, unfortunately, but you're going to be more likely to make that diagnosis if you've tuned into your patient.
Well, you've started this journey that resulted in a book. So I was wondering if you would tell us, on this journey that you took, what are some of the favorite stories about kindness that you observed or experienced in your world travel?
The first one was the one that's closest to home. It was in Scarberia. It was in Scarborough. And I met Mark Wafer, who until late last year owned 6 Tim Hortons. And he calls them restaurants, which blew me away. Like, welcome to my restaurant.
I'm so glad you're talking about Tim Hortons. It just emphasizes that, yes, this is an international global podcast, but it's still so Canadian, eh?
It's double-double, and I'm going to give you a double-double of Mark Wafer. Schaefer. He owned 6 Tim Hortons that were the most profitable in the entire system. Same donuts, you know, same grilled cheese sandwiches and ice caps. So what made his restaurants more profitable is that he had the lowest turnover, staff turnover, in the entire system. 55%. That included, you know, that's all employees, all in. He said that the average turnover at most fast food restaurants, not just Tim's, but, you know, Wendy's, McDonald's, etc., is 100 to 125% per year. So he told me, take a photo, go into a Tim's, go into a McDonald's, take a photo of the people who are there, come back in a year. They'll all be different. And that's a problem if you own the place, because it costs, he says, an average of $4,000 to recruit, interview, train, equip each new hire.
But he did invest in a very unique skill set of employees that resulted in a very dedicated...
I don't know how he did it.
I read the book.
Okay. He hired people with challenges. He was the most inclusive employer in the system. And starting with his very first hire, his name is Clint Sparling. Clint Sparling was 21 at the time. He had never worked a day in his life, had worked in some sheltered workshops. He has Down syndrome. And he cold called. He'd been getting some training with a wonderful outfit called Community Living Toronto. And he cold called them. He wanted a job. He asked Mark Wafer for a job, walked in there, and Mark took one look at him and said, if I don't hire him, nobody else will, which is kind of a pessimistic point of view. But he promised to hire him, but he didn't know if Clint could do a job. So he worked out a deal with Community Living. They trained him for several weeks. Mark attended the graduation. Kinds of things he was being taught, you know, just basic life skills, like how to navigate the city on the TTC, on the Toronto Transit Commission, you know, take the buses, and all the things he'd need to do to be able to function at work. And he hired him. And, you know, very soon after he hired him, basically he was cleaning tables. He was picking up garbage outside and inside. And then he got some more responsibilities, and then more and more. He was involved in some of the food prep. He was involved in cleaning the dishwasher, you know, using the dishwasher to clean the cups. And as Mark said, that's a very complicated job that involves chemicals, and it's a skilled job. And he, you know, he came into that whole experiment, and it was an experiment, it's 20 years ago, thinking, you know, that Clint was going to be his most challenging employee. Turned out to be his best employee. He arrived early, wore his uniform with pride. They had to make an exception in his case that he could wear his uniform on the bus. And he left late, and he brought a wonderful ethos to the restaurant. And he had an amazing effect on the employees who didn't have challenges.
It creates a culture, right? It creates a culture. And I see this happen in the emergency department. If you invest in the people that you work with and you show that you care about them and that you're kind to them and you support them and you have their back, boy, they'll go to the mat for you. You'll help each other out. You'll stay late on shift when it's that person. And all of a sudden, the whole department rises up to the occasion. And everybody's seeing the same pretty much type of patients, give or take, the same volumes and stuff like that by our staffing. And yet how we as a group rise to that, and I think Clint's an excellent example of it, that he believed in it, he invested in them, and it changed the culture, and then he ended up having the most profitable Tim Hortons.
Yeah, and I went around to all of his 6 restaurants, and they all don't just talk the talk, they walk the walk. Mark discovered other things about being an inclusive employer. They were safer. They didn't take the same kind of risks that you and I take. They problem solve from the moment they wake up in the morning. By the time they get to the restaurant, they've problem solved in ways that most other people have never had to do, and they do it every day. So can you see what he's doing? He was empathizing with them. And that skill began years earlier when he would empathize, and when he worked at the car dealership in the service department, and he was the service rep, the guy or the woman who you bring your car to. They do the intake and get your contact information. The car gets driven into the shop, into the garage, and then sometime later on, Mark would be the guy who would call you up and tell you your kadiddle is blown, it's $2,000. And you better believe that person. If you don't have rapport with that person, if you don't trust that person, you're going to take your car someplace else. You're going to say, I want another estimate. And he was really good at it. And he demonstrated to me an uncanny ability to empathize with the car owner who was coming in. They'd missed their breakfast, he said. You could see he's got a mental scheme of what they look like. They've missed their breakfast. Their life has been turned upside down. This is $2,000 they can't afford. But he had one problem. Well, I'm calling it a problem, and people who are going to find out what's going on with Mark, you know, why he was such an empathetic guy, might be offended if I say he had a problem. So he had a challenge. He was born deaf. And it's not that the deafness held him back. It didn't. He found many ways. As you find out in the book, he's a race car driver. He's a risk taker. It was being discounted because of the deafness. And that started at an early age when he was in the UK. He was in school. On his first report card, he quoted it. People remember these things. Under music, Mark has no musical ability. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Beethoven was composing symphonies when he was deaf. So that's ridiculous.
But, you know, that he turned it into an advantage because in reading his story, he paid attention to people. He had to lip read. He had to focus in on their face. He had to connect and see all those motions and those emotions showing up in someone's face and perceive them and then reflect them back to people and say, geez, I can see you're having a bad day. What's wrong with your car? You know, and I've used that in the emergency department. You walk in the room and you see the shoulders shrugged and the expression on somebody's face, and I say, wow, I can see you're having a bad day. Tell me, what's going on?
I'm asking you questions now. Can you walk into a room full of people and figure out in a second if they're happy, sad, edgy?
Most of the time, it works. Every once in a while, it'll throw you. But most of the time, I think we can walk in, and we're cultural beings, right? We're social beings, and we respond to that with people. And so when you look at someone, you go, oh, I think they're mad at me, or, oh, they look happy, or what's going on? They seem preoccupied or distracted. So, yeah, I think that's something that we have. You've told a great story about Canadian donut shops, which I love. I don't want to tell everybody about all your great stories because I want them to go out and experience it, because it was a joy to read the book and have it unfold. And it's nice to have you telling it, but I also want them to read it. So I'm going to move on and ask you about kindness. Is it nature or is it nurture? Are we born being kind, or is it something we need to learn and develop?
It's, you know, I'm going to answer like a good Canadian. It's both. As I said, mums and babies enter a state of synchrony with one another. It's probably mediated by oxytocin, which has been called the kindness chemical. I don't want to overestimate the value. There are studies that suggest that oxytocin, you know, as a nasal spray might give us a quick burst of kindness, a quick burst of empathy. But I think it needs a lot more work. Can it turn a psychopath into somebody who's kind? Probably not.
Wouldn't that be great if we could just reach for a nasal spray?
If you think about it, babies are born helpless. They can breathe, but they can't feed themselves. They can't ambulate. So they need parents to nurture them and take care of them. And so it kind of makes sense in an evolutionary sense that we would be born with some predisposition to love babies. And, you know, it may be the appearance of a baby's face that's attractive to us. Like, many of us just can't resist bending down to...
You got to turn into the, oh, God, oh, you're so good, look at it. Yeah, and we've all done that, right? We've all leaned over the bassinet. And
by instinct, you're entering synchrony with the baby. You want the baby to do, I make faces at the baby makes faces at me. And you know, there's other really intriguing stuff. Newborns cry when other newborns cry in the NICU, in the newborn nursery. Newborns cry when their mom cries. Newborns do not cry when another mother, like the mother of another newborn, cries. So the specificity of that, the selectivity of the response, suggests to me that there's at least a strong nature component. But is it all nature? No, of course not. At the highest levels of executive function, empathy is a choice. kindness is a choice. And it's always, you're constantly weighing, you know, my interest and your interest, my family's interest and your family's interest, the competing interests of 20 patients, 25 patients in the emergency department, if you happen to be an emergency physician, or if you're the intensivist on duty in the intensive care unit. And just think about it. Just think about the emotional needs of the families of every patient in the intensive care unit. They must be enormous. And you can't be there for everybody in every moment all the time. You're human, plus you're going to make mistakes. And there will be times when you will be paying attention to your own distress because you're in distress. And you can't always flush out your distress when you go to work. So you have to, you know, I think we have to give each other a bit more slack about that. So I'm going to say it's a lot of nature, but a lot of nurture. And unfortunately, it has a lot to do with our experience, our early childhood experience. If you are not exposed to a loving, attached relationship with your parents, worse still, if you've been abused, if you've been subjected to emotional, physical, or sexual harm, there's a good chance that you're going to grow up into an adult who repeats the cycle and is not kind and empathetic to others. So that's quite a load to carry with you as you become an adult.
Well, let's turn on to healthcare workers then and talk about healthcare workers, because you talked about the sense of empathy being dulled over the years. And as I reflect upon my own practice and think, yeah, there's some truth to that. I've gone through a cycle where, geez, I felt like I was getting less empathetic. And now I think I'm on the upswing and I'm feeling more empathetic. And I've come through that.
That's interesting. Like the waves of your career. Yeah.
And I don't know if it's the stage I'm at, the age I'm at, my life stage and stuff like that. But there certainly was, you know, you get a bit of immunity to it. Like, oh, yeah, they're in pain. Oh, whatever. They're complaining. Right. And you talk about that in the book about, you know, healthcare workers getting, you know, putting up some walls and some barriers to feeling and being emotional with their patients.
So let's start with the observation that led to that's led to this interesting line of research. It's a line of research, no conclusions right now, but it appears that seasoned veteran healthcare professionals, nurses and physicians, probably paramedics as well, underestimate the pain of patients. So if they're shown a series of faces in rapid fire sequence, you know, and they have to position the joystick far left, no pain, far right, maximum pain, they will position the cue, the reading, the meter, their reading of the patient's pain at a lesser level of pain than a novice, than somebody who is not a healthcare professional. And the interesting research that's being done by Professor Phil Jackson, who is a neuroscientist at Laval University, he's a researcher in empathy, and I talk about him in the book, is that they're starting to do studies of functional MRIs of people, health professionals, compared to normal subjects, scoring the photographs of people in various states of pain, various facial expressions, actors with reproducible reactions or perceptions of level of pain by research subjects. And they're doing functional MRIs of them to see which parts of their brain light up, and do they light up as brilliantly as for healthcare workers as they do in normal subjects. I'm not going to give all the results of that, in part because it's preliminary.
Well, I was going to say, you put your head in the magnet. But don't tell us the results yet, okay? But you did put your head in that magnet, that functional MRI, and were exposed to those faces and had various parts of your brain light up. But let's leave that for people to discover.
And let's get back to the underestimating pain. Why would we assign a patient who's grimacing a lower number of pain than a layperson might? And you can think of a whole bunch of nurture reasons, experiential reasons why. You know, I'm looking at this one face, but I've seen thousands of faces.
And when was the last time you walked into a room and you said, on a scale of 0 to 10, what's your pain? And they say, oh, I'm an 11, and they're texting. And all of a sudden, you're just like, ugh. And it just... And it frames it for everyone else who comes in as well. And, you know, when they're telling you, I've got more than 10 out of 10 pain, they're trying to connect with you. And rather than blowing them off and saying, really, roll your eyes, what we should be doing is, wow, you're in a lot of pain. How can we help you today with that?
I agree. But I usually, if I get the number, I go back and I ask them, what's the worst pain experience you've ever had in your life? They tell me that. If I'm thinking that it's at odds, if that's the one,
You want to make it relative to that.
I want to make it relative to that, not in a vacuum, not a number in a vacuum.
And it's compared to your pain
right.
that you've experienced. How bad is this pain that you're experiencing now?
Well, the head scratcher for me was always, what if the worst pain you ever had was a hangnail? How would you possibly able to?
What's your frame of reference?
Right.
So that's the worst pain.
So that's one reason why we might have trouble, why we might underestimate the pain in patients. We have perspective. We've seen thousands of people just like that patient. And so we have some perspective. The other thing is it may be cultural. It may be that we're already starting to dread the possibility that there's going to be an opioid prescription attached to that level of pain, and we don't want to do that. We want to condition our patients. We're it's like, if I don't see the pain, maybe it's not there, and maybe I don't have to prescribe opioids. So those are some of the speculative reasons that were given by Jackson and his associates, Mathieu Garon, and it's just an interesting finding. That's all.
Well, the whole interaction with patients and stuff reminds me of a quote that I pulled, and that's from Maya Angelou, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And she said, at the end of the day, people won't remember what you said or did, but they'll remember how you made them feel. And if we circle back to that first story of that spouse, you made them feel bad.
Yeah.
And what we really want to do is make people feel good. And it doesn't mean we're always going to fix every problem, we're going to save every life, but how you act in that moment colors that situation so incredibly. I've learned that over the last probably 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Just being able to be there for that person. I mean, you're doing all your intellectual stuff.
And you have to keep doing that, but you've got this other level conversation going on. And, you know, it's back to that family. It's instead of being annoyed, not what I was expressing was intimidation, feeling intimidated by a phalanx of adult family members, and my worst fear being that they'd start peppering me with questions like a committee interview, and after 3 or 4 I don't knows, what is this, an idiot? Why get us another physician? Or but picking out the contradictions that I've said, seeing them as a problem instead of thinking about, whatever stuff you had going on today that was supposed to be going on, it isn't because you're here.
You're having a bad day, and I'm probably making it worse.
Yeah. So starting to empathize with them and also thinking, wow, I've seen a lot of lonely older people brought to my emergency department who have no family member in sight, and you've got 5 of them.
Isn't that great? You have people that love you and care about you. And I've done that many times when patients said, well, I didn't really want to come. And it's like, I guess they love you.
Yeah.
Because they wanted you to come in and be seen.
Exactly. Or noticing that it's 5 o'clock in the morning and I've kept them up all night, the adult children, for instance, or a spouse, and thinking, oh, I don't know how you can stay awake. Making them realize that I understand how awful the uncertainty of the process of healthcare, but emergency healthcare in particular.
And it might be the first time they've been in that situation, and you've been in it for how many years? Decades, right?
Right.
I've been in it for 2 decades, and I've been in that emergency. That's my home. That's where I feel comfortable working and operating. But that's a very unnatural place for them. And I'm sure that if I get into somebody else's workplace and it would be very stressful, I would feel very nervous and wouldn't know the right thing to say and stumble through it. And
or they've been told you should stay by your loved one because I might come in. And it might be in an hour or it might be in 3 hours, and they have no idea. It could be anything in between, and they have no idea when it's going to be. They want to step out for a minute. They live in terror that they step out, and that's the moment that I walk in. And so just acknowledging that this uncertainty is driving them crazy, because I've been there and it's driven me crazy too, as the son of 2 parents now both gone, who I think combined were admitted to hospital in the last 2 years of their life a total of 14 times. So I've gotten some experience of what it's like to be on the other side of the gurney, as I like to say.
So what can the SGEMers, the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine audience, who provide emergency care, what can they do to become kinder?
Fortunately, it's not hard, because unless you're a narcissist, a psychopath, or a Machiavellian, And I mean the personality disorder, not the traits. The traits scatter through the population. They make us interesting. But unless you have those, you're hardwired for empathy. And so all you're doing is setting the stage for your natural ability to come to the fore. So the first thing you should do is whatever stuff you've got that's going on in your life, you've got to clear it when you work. You can't let yourself be distracted by personal stuff while you're working. So as much as you can, center yourself. I do it by breathing. Breathe into a count of six, hold to a count of six, let it out slowly, evenly to a count of six. And I exaggerate it, hold.
Just so everybody knows, he's counting to six.
I'm counting to six, and then I let it out like that. And, sometimes I'll use my fingers to wring out the last bit of air.
I sit in the parking lot often, and I think people, in the kitchen are looking out over into the parking lot where the doctors pull in and going, what's he doing? And I'm doing mindfulness for the 5 or 10 minutes before my shift. I just sit and I breathe and I focus on the now and I clear everything and then I start.
Yeah. The mindfulness that I do, I use the parade metaphor. We get into trouble, if you have a personality that tends to latch onto negative thoughts and just let them, start ruminating, I go into parade mode where I kind of pull myself back and I'm in the reviewing stand of a parade, and I turn those bad thoughts into floats. So the consultant who scowls when they see me or kind of
barks at you whenever you call, or
they don't bark. They're just the one I'm thinking about kind of has that averted gaze when they look at me as if they're remembering. So I'll give them a name, like a Captain Obvious name, like a consultant who never forgives me for the patient from hell that I referred to them 32 years ago.
If you talk about this parade too much, you're going to ruin the Disney parade for me. So I get it. There's a parade.
And the point is, you don't latch on. You don't jump onto the back of the float and say, I want to live here and build a house here. Just let it go. Okay. When I walk into the room, to the cubicle to see a patient, I remember to smile. Smiling is so important. People adore smiles.
And it's hard not to smile back when you smile at someone.
Yeah. I use my humor. I make a joke. Somebody's reading a book. I'll say, so how many chapters did you get through? And, it relaxes them a bit. If there is a phalanx, a phalanx of family members, I walk up to each of them, shake their hands, and introduce myself to them. I'm saying you're all important in this room.
You're recognizing them as being important, just like you said. I've learned to say, and you are, because too many times it turns out to be the sister, not the wife, or the brother, not the husband. And so I just say, I'm the doctor, and you are?
And you're empathizing with them because you might get into some privacy discussions. So now we're starting to say things like, can we discuss, I see what looks like a couple in the room.
And it might be the neighbor.
Exactly. So what you're doing is you're saying, I understand that my perceptions may be incorrect, so I'm going to check them. I sit. I don't stand over patients.
Excellent.
And I slow down because it's not speed. You can't get away from speed, like having to run around. It's time pressure. That means being distracted in the moment when I'm supposed to be focusing on you. I'm distracted by having to go to 5 other places. You can do things to try to engineer your time so that when you do speak to a patient or when you're taking that initial history, you're not distracted constantly. You can go to the ward clerk and say, I don't want to be disturbed right now. But that should be mandatory if you're breaking bad news, that you give the phone to somebody else, that you're not distracted by that, because you have to realize that what may be the 150th conversation like that you've had is the one and only time they're going to hear it, and it's the worst of all possible news, and you owe it to them to just be there for them in that moment.
Well, in the emergency department, we want to have the trifecta of being quick, so being very efficient, being very good, and what I mean by good is diagnosticians, especially in the emergency department, we're diagnosticians, but we also have some technical and procedural skills as well. But we also want to be kind, so that's caring, empathetic, compassionate. But I think we focus too much on the first two, and we let that last one, that third one, that kindness slide, and yet it is so important to that interaction and recognizing humans having agency and having value.
We have turned tearing into a default, into a false dichotomy. You're either caring or you're technically, you know, brilliant. And having technical skill, you know, having a prodigious memory for Harrison's textbook of internal medicine and Rosen and Tintinelli does not make you a good person, a kind person. You can be caring and you can be competent. Patients aren't looking for one or the other. You should be both.
Yeah. Well, throughout the book, you seem to struggle with whether or not you're a kind person. I haven't had very many experiences with you. Most of them have been virtual, electronically. In fact, until today, we hadn't met face-to-face. But all of my experiences so far have validated that Brian Goldman, you are a kind person.
Aw, thank you. So are you. You are a very sensitive guy.
Well, you need to say it out loud, and I say that to patients. I just need to say it out loud. I need to say it to the patient. I need to say it to you. So my experiences with you have been very positive, and I've grown and really learned through those virtual experiences, through the FOMED world, and making connections that have led us to today where we can actually meet face to face. Is there anything else, though, that you would like to say? This is just the open-ended at the end of it, to the SGEMers about your book or about kindness or anything else?
Yeah, just one thing. Kindness is not about win-lose. It's about win-win. When we are unkind, there are times when we can't be there for everybody all the time. But when we have kind of when we've fallen below our own standard for kindness, our own personal standard, not a medical standard, personal standard, we know it. We go home. On the way home, it eats at us. We don't know why. We're grumpy, and we don't know why. Our blood pressure goes up. Our heart rate goes up because our stress hormones go up. And the opposite is true. If you're kind, it's like a bottomless pit. It's a well that just replenishes itself. It makes the world a better place. It does make you a better physician, a better diagnostician, to be a more caring and kind person. And all I can say is try it. I don't think you'll regret it.
I don't think you'll regret it at all. Well, thank you for coming on the SGEM to discuss your book about the power of kindness and why empathy is essential in everyday life. But we always have the guest skeptics read the tagline. And so if you could read the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.